Hello and welcome to episode 32 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man. My name is Graham Lee. Today's topic is the presentation of code and the integration of ideas from programming beyond the code into that code viewing and editing experience. Essentially, I'm talking about the IDE, or Integrated Development Environment. And really, to some extent, about the passing of the idea of the IDE. I want to start by looking at the state of integrated development environments as they are now. But this is a sort of topic of interest of mine I've had for a very long time. In around 2015, I had a project called Class Browser, which brought a sort of Smalltalk-like immediate code environment to Objective-C, along with the eponymous Class Browser, which is again an idea inherited from Smalltalk, that showed the live state of the classes and inheritance hierarchies and methods within the running system. Now, Smalltalk is, of course, a place, a computing environment in which the code editing and execution are very tightly coupled. You're writing code in the live running system. And so it has very different, and its community has very different ideas about the way that these things are integrated and presented than exists in a lot of other programming communities. It really is a community-driven thing. It's about the norms and expectations of the people in that community. But I'm running ahead of myself. Yeah, I was talking about Class Browser and about the fact that I've had this interesting code presentation for a very long time. If you look back at my blog, you'll see articles on doing literate programming in LibreOffice, and also ideas about what we can learn from ancient manuscripts and the way that they surface different information in different ways. So I've had this sort of long-running interest in both the information that we use as programmers and software engineers, and how we gain access to that information, and also how other spheres of human endeavor have presented and shared information, to see whether we can learn anything from that. So, as I was saying, I wanted to start with a sort of survey of the way things work, and I think you'll find very different ideas in the Smalltalk world, particularly in terms of modern Smalltalk, in the Faro project, which is very much focused on providing sort of developer efficiency features. There's also Truffle Squeak, which is interesting for developer efficiency purposes, but for very different reasons. Really, if you're looking for novel ways to inspect applications or source code or the relationship between them, then Faro is the place to look. Although, of course, if you look at other small talks like Squeak, then you find things like block coding and visual programming environments such as Scratch, which were developed on top of them. The closest thing to the Smalltalk way of working in what you might call sort of mainstream programming is really the JavaScript world, if you do what most JavaScript programmers do not, i.e. if you program directly in your browser, because then you are again targeting the running environment. This is hard to do for a lot of like engineered JavaScript applications because of specific choices made by that community to, you know, have transpilers, to use like processes like Babel that transform the JavaScript from one form to another before it gets run, which makes what you see in the browser very much read-only. You can get a source map which tells you where in your source project a particular idea in the JavaScript comes from, but you can't then sort of change that very easily. Then you get other tools built on top of that with ideas like Watchman that do allow you to at least live update the browser's code based on changes to the JavaScript, the source code, but don't allow you to round trip it. So you can't make a change in the browser based on like your observations of the live behavior and have that change reflected in your source, at least not yet. But yeah, most JavaScript projects are using like a separate standalone text editor, and it really is a text editor, something like Visual Studio Code that has syntax highlighting and an integrated terminal and some like nice code-centric keyboard shortcuts. But it isn't an integrated development environment. The development is done at the editor, and then the deployment is done in the terminal, and then execution, debugging, testing, and so on are done in the browser. If you're looking for sort of mainstream, actually integrated IDEs, integrated development environments, then really the ones that have the tightest integration are Visual Studio from Microsoft, although I have to say I've been using Visual Studio for Mac a lot lately, which is not a great experience, but I understand that they are currently in the process of rewriting that, and you know, I'm sure that they have like learned from the telemetry, from the user feedback, and from the experiences of Visual Studio on Windows, and that, you know, so I'm not going to sort of rag on Visual Studio on the basis of my experience of VS for Mac. Visual Studio itself is a very nicely integrated development environment. And the other one that is very similar is Apple's Xcode. Now, the reason that some people don't like Xcode and prefer to use something like AppCode is for the code editing facilities. But the actual sort of integration of Xcode is perhaps one of the most advanced that exists. You can visualize live object graphs from within the IDE, where you're also editing your code and you're modifying previews of your UI as it will be rendered in your application. It's not as tight integration as something like Smalltalk, because you're not running Xcode within the deployed system. But it certainly does surface a lot of different information and give you a lot of different dimensions for accessing your code. But then pretty much everybody else is using the, you know, VS Code style glorified text editors. Some people are even not using glorified text editors. They're using actual just straightforward text editors like Vim or Emacs in 80 by 24 terminal windows. And you know, I think that what people get out of this, which is the thing that they are looking for, is definitely efficiency, and it is efficiency at performing their workflow, where their workflow is based on, you know, editing the code and then making changes to the deployed system and seeing what it does, either the REPL approach to nearly live development, or a sort of, you know, compile or rather edit, compile, run, debug sort of cycle, even one that's mediated by something like test driven development. What this points to is that these optimizations are optimizations for a particular workflow and are not being critical of that workflow itself. They're not asking the question, is this the best way to work that is possible? You know, okay, we make working in this fashion better by having more macros in our text editors, or you know, like clutch foot pedals for operating the meta key or whatever. But is there fundamentally a different way of working than the one where we edit the text and then look at what happens and then go back to editing the text? And the experience of the experience of the other IDEs shows that it is possible, that there are different workflows, and that surfacing other information and integrating that into the coding experience could be worthwhile. And in fact, potentially points to an even more radical interpretation, where we say maybe the code editing experience should be secondary. Maybe we should be looking at some other visualization of the running system or of the application that we're working on that then surfaces the source code at the time where we need to make a change to it, and doesn't surface the source code project as the sort of fundamental truth or the ground point for exploring the application. Finally, a special shout out for some other notable mention IDEs, RStudio and MATLAB, which are heavily used in scientific programming, which are kind of so much a batteries included experience that a lot of people see the tools as, you know, as being the experience, and the programming languages as the sort of scripting interface for those tools. So, you know, a lot of people who are doing statistics work will think of it as, you know, using RStudio for generating their graphs, not as programming in R, even though what they are doing is programming in R. So what are some of the other pieces of information that we could use? Well, some of them are kind of exposed in the programming environment, but not in a very well integrated way. So for example, change history. Change history tells you a lot about the evolution of the code, you know, of the project. It tells you a lot about what has changed, and if the commit messages are any good, then it tells you something about why it has changed so much as well. And this is really useful information. If you've got a thing that keeps changing because the implementation wasn't correct, because there were often bugs in one particular module of the code, or one particular class, or one particular function, and people, like programmers, had to keep coming back and updating it to fix different bugs. That points to a risky area of the code, because every person who touches this doesn't understand the problem they're trying to solve, and, you know, either incompletely solves it or adds new breakages as they fix existing things. As well as the risk, it might point to a poorly specified part of the problem. You know, this is an area where you actually need to go and talk more to the rest of the project team and come up with an idea of what it is that this bit should be doing. Or it could be an indication that you should just go and pay for some off-the-shelf component, or find some open source module that solves this particular piece of the problem, because it isn't being well handled by your project team. Conversely, if something is constantly changing because the requirements around it keep changing, then maybe that means that that component should be data-driven. It should be possible to specify its behavior from configuration files, maybe written by analysts. Maybe it points to the customers not knowing what they want from that feature, and you know, maybe you'd be better off like removing the feature entirely and seeing what they complain about. You know, see where they say, oh, I really wanted to be able to do X, and I see you took that away, when you had actually built a feature for doing Y prime that they were merely using for X, which is why they kept asking for changes. It could be time to, you know, go back to the drawing board. But you need to know why and where the changes arise. What we get is the ability to review the difference between the files as they existed before we started working and their current state, or we get the chance to look at the difference between one particular revision in history and another, or we get the ability to see the what is called the blame view or the annotation view or the praise view. We get to see who was last responsible for a change on each line of the file, which is not the same as saying who wrote each line of code, and is not even, and is, you know, nowhere near the same as saying who wrote each statement, and is very, very far from saying who designed this. So it's a very incomplete view of the history, but history tells us very useful things about what in the project is failing. Because ultimately our, you know, if we believe the Agile Manifesto principle that our, you know, primary goal is satisfying the customer through early and continuous delivery of working software, then we shouldn't be constantly going back and changing things, whether it's because we got it wrong or because we didn't understand what they wanted, which is the same, or because they weren't able to express what they wanted, which is the same. So, you know, there, any time there's a lot of churn, there's information about where faults in a project are likely to lie, and also information about what those faults are likely to look like, and we don't get that information in our IDEs. You would if you're looking at an ancient manuscript, because the way they were written was on parchment, which is like, parchment is animal skin. It's fairly thick. And you do all sorts of stuff like, you know, bathing it in a fairly nasty vat of chemicals, including various acids, to like get the hair off, then scrape even more to like get the hair out, and to like sort of flatten over the pores, and this is all while it's tensioned on a big rack, and it's dried, and you still end up with a fairly thick sheet. And so, like, rather than rubbing out with an eraser as we do with graphite pencils now, if a scribe made a mistake writing a manuscript, then they would probably take a knife and scratch away the top layer and then go back and write the correct version. Or they would cross out what they'd written and write the correct version over the top or along the side, or even in the margins. So you would get information about how much particular portions had changed based on the accumulated, you know, scrapings and crossings and marginalia, and so you would get an idea of where the like problems were likely to lie. And you could imagine that if they had stuck consistently with the scraping technique, then the thinner the manuscript, i.e. the more backlight shone through it, the more likely it was that that part of the text was erroneous. And if it was in a table, then it could be because that table wasn't calculated particularly well, or because the values kept having to be updated. And the idea of marginalia takes me on to the conversation I had this morning with Autor Therox, that was the sort of genesis of this episode. He's been doing some interesting work in the field of programmer documentation and using presentation techniques from illuminated manuscripts and from early printed works. The thing that he showed, which of course link in show notes, was very similar to like early Johannes Gutenberg printed books, such as his Bible or his edition of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And we were talking about the idea of textual commentary and meta-commentary, because there's various forms of commentary that we get as developers. One is code review. Now, most code review doesn't appear in the IDE because it happens at a separate juncture and in a separate service. It happens on GitHub or on Bitbucket or on Fabricator until the end of June or wherever. And so we get this kind of weird dualism in our presentation of the code, that our IDEs will let us see, because they integrate with our version control systems, they will let us see any particular committed version. And in order to understand the conversation that was had during the transition from one version to another, we have to look over in our code review tool, which is a different tool. So we've got the idea of sort of atomic increments of source code in the IDE, and then the idea of sort of chronic changes of like discussions and of back and forths and of reviews followed by updates followed by reviews followed by updates happening in this other context. So we don't get to see both in the same region, and that would again be useful information if you're looking at some code trying to understand why there's a bug in the implementation of a particular object, and you see that a method was recently changed. Why can't you see the conversation that surrounded that change? If you're lucky, then the commits, so the atomic increments in the code refer to the bug ID or the ticket ID in the review tool. If you're unlucky, then you use a different review tool from Bug Tracker, and so they only refer to the description of the problem that motivated the change and not to the conversation that happened around the acceptance and integration of this change. So we've lost the information. And of course, if you're very unlucky, then the commits make no reference to that, and there is no way to uncover any sort of idea of why it was changed, let alone what happened during the process of that change. And of course, early manuscript technology did include meta-commentary. Very famously, the Lindisfarne Gospels are written in Latin. The Lindisfarne Gospels, so named because they were produced and stored until a Viking raid in the abbey at Lindisfarne. And they are Latin Gospels, very ornately decorated and presumably kept in a very high value either binding or casket, which would have definitely been robbed for its precious metals and jewels during the Viking raid. Anyway, it is a Latin edition of the Gospels, hand produced at great expense and great time commitment. And someone has written in very small handwriting, directly on the page, they have written a gloss translation into Old English of the Latin text of the Gospels, which is a brilliant brilliant artifact for our modern purposes, because it allows us to understand and translate words in Old English that we don't necessarily have from attested from other sources. Of course, it's slightly problematic. We don't get the grammar, because the grammar is still the Latin grammar of the Gospels with a word-for-word English translation over the top. But we do get to understand and make this translation. And where there are longer notes, we get to understand something about the thinking of this translator. I think the person names themselves and describes why they're doing what is effectively graffitiing a very expensive manuscript. So this could be a presentation of code view. It could be like marginalia. It could be notes alongside the text where the questions are asked. And of course, this is not a ludicrous idea, because that's how review comments are presented in Microsoft Word and Google Documents and other places where reviewers are asked to critique written text. The track changes exists in those documents, in those word processors as well, which show a way to display a sort of version history in line in the presentation of the document. So it's only that the world of the programmer has chosen not to display this information that means that we don't have it in IDEs. It isn't impossible, and it isn't undesirable by people who are writing commentaries. But I think it would be incredibly useful when you are, when you are making a change that has review comments attached to it, to be able to see those in your code editing environment, so to have them directly to hand. You know, we often say about documentation that if it isn't stored alongside the code, and even in cases where it is stored alongside the code, it very quickly goes out of date. Well, you can just shove it right next to the code. The same goes for comments and API documentation. Of course, tools like JavaDoc and its various Doxygen and their various sort of influence tools do put the API documentation in comments alongside the declarations of the functions or methods that implement the API. But there's no reason why they have to be just in the header files or just up the top, as in, in these tools, the comment goes at the top. They could be presented alongside. Even where they are stored logically at the top above the definition. When you are working with a parameter inside the implementation of the functional method, the documentation for that parameter could be shown alongside. And of course, that is done in editors like Visual Studio, and the JetBrains IDEs and so on, and is not done in these sort of purely textual editing experiences like VI or Nano or whatever. Interestingly, the editor experience that seems to be coming up a lot lately, that is one that is very old and that I personally don't find a lot of use for, is the mini-map. So the mini-map is where you have essentially usually one pixel per character of text in a sort of diagrammatic presentation of the whole flow of text along down the side of the document, which provides a sort of overview for where you are in the document. And I first encountered this in a product called Logosoft Pendown, which was a word processor for the BBC Micro and the Acorn Archimedes series of computers in the 80s and 90s. And it existed on the BBC Micro, the Minimap existed, because there was no zoom, because the display was fixed resolution and the text characters came from a font in ROM. You could only display text at a fixed size. So if you were working on a long document, you had no way of like quickly seeing where you were in the document. So they came up with this idea of the mini map down the side of the document to kind of show you a bit of a like 50,000 foot view. And of course, like plenty of people say, well, if you need a 50,000 foot view of your text file, then even when you're editing code, then you have done something wrong. And I'm not here to critique that. I think that you may have done something wrong, but you may have done several incremental steps of doing things right that have ended up in a place that you would prefer not to be. And it's not my position to judge that. But there are other code presentation techniques that IDEs or code editors in general have that are incompatible with the idea of minimap presentation. The most extreme example being the code bubbles idea, but even just code folding in fairly feature poor code editors is an example, a case in point, that you can it essentially sort of collapse a semantic block of code. So maybe like one branch in an if statement, or the body of a loop, or the implementation of a function. And then that is hidden. And so you're scrolling past multiple lines of code at a time as you go past it. But then that means that if your minimap is showing you what is currently visible, then it isn't showing you where you are in the long document. It's showing you where you are in a folded up version of a long document. And if it isn't collapsed, then it isn't helping you to interpret what you're seeing in the text view. So there's no way that the two of them can be reconciled. And what the prevalence of this feature in recent code editors kind of says to me that we've reached the end of improving the text is dominant workflow, that we've run out of new directions in which to take the idea of software development as a sort of text first paradigm. And if we want to look for new improvements, we have to step out into the other plane. We have to look at what are radical ways of editing code, or rather, what are radical ways of building software and early and continuous delivery of software to customers. Maybe we have to stop thinking about building code in toto, and we have to start thinking about delivering software and working backwards to a construction experience from a radical rethink of that goal. If you have ideas on that, I'd love to hear about them. Either comment on the post in the blog where you found this podcast, or email me, grahamlee@acm.org. Thank you very much, and I will talk to you again soon.